Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. Well, whether or not the Russian campaign to interfere in the election was a highly organized Vladimir Putin operation or not, we do know that most of those efforts were carried out online and on social media. Now, a new report from the U.S. NGO Freedom House says that governments of 30 countries around the world are using, quote, armies of opinion shapers to meddle in elections, advance anti-democratic agendas, and repress their citizens. And that's all happening on the internet. This broad and often frightening use of social media, it all comes as no surprise to journalist David Patrick Arikos. He's written a new book about how social media is changing the face of conflict in our modern era. After years covering conflicts overseas, he says Twitter and Facebook are drastically changing war. From troll farms in Russia pumping out propaganda online to citizens using Facebook to crowdsource arms for battle. The book is called War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. And David is with me now in the studio. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start with this question that I covered with Mikhail Zeger. He brought it up too. What is a troll farm and why is it so important in what you're covering, which is modern conflict and modern war?
Well, a troll farm, that's quite an exotic way. I like to think of it as a troll factory, essentially, and the most, you know, famous and prominent one is on a street in St. Petersburg. And what it is literally a factory full of trolls, and they pump out various bits of propaganda. And what is so amazing about this is how organized it is. I mean, they even have floors. So on the first floor, they have journalists writing fake articles. Around the time of the height of the Russia-Ukraine war, they were pretending, you know, they were setting up websites with .uae endings to make it look like they're based in Ukraine. And then on the second floor, they would have people creating memes to spread around. On the third floor, they'd have fake bloggers. So bloggers pretending to be Ukrainians saying, oh, there's no food in the city, kindergartens don't have electricity. And often those bloggers, or they pretend to be Americans saying, we agree with Putin, the whole world supports Russia. And on the fourth floor were the big boys, the Twitter and social media trolls. Mm. And actually, it was a whole merry-go-round of lies, because that fake US blogger, quote-unquote, would often become a source for the fake article being written on the first floor. So why are they important? They're important because the nature of war is changing. And look, propaganda is as old as war itself. But what in traditional warfare, propaganda operations have traditionally supported military operations on the ground. What we're seeing, and this truly is remarkable, is military operations on the ground supporting propaganda operations. Now, look, the Russia-Ukraine conflict is a classic example. Now, under traditional war, you know, Clausewitz, famously the war theorist, said war is the continuation of politics with other means. Now what you're seeing is war as politics itself. So traditionally, war would be two or more sides have a fight in a, you know, a geographical area almost as delineated as a boxing ring. The winner would then impose a political settlement on the loser. Classic example is the Treaty of Versailles after World War One.
This is risk. Move the pieces in and get a surrender.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. But look at Russia in Ukraine. Putin never had any intention of defeating Ukraine, which he easily could have done, and forcing it to the negotiating table. He never had any intention of doing it. What he did instead, and I saw this firsthand, is sent troops across the border to destabilize the Ukraine by destabilizing its east. Now, how did he do this? Not by killing a load of people. Yes, he needed to support separatists. He needed troops to occupy cities of eastern Ukraine. But he did this by Russian state TV and social media promulgating a narrative. And that was that Ukraine was, the government was a fascist junta that wanted to persecute Russian speakers and the Russian people. And essentially, that is a political goal.
And you equate warfare like this with the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, with lots of other conflicts around the world. You say that social media now means that war occupies a gray zone.
Yes.
Between conflict and peace. It's not killing in war and then peacetime. That's gone.
It's not social media alone. It's the fact that the line between war and politics is blurred. Because when Putin is trying to get Eastern Ukrainians to subscribe to a particular narrative. That's a political, not a military goal. I spoke to US and UK soldiers who served in Afghanistan. And in the end, the goal became not to defeat the Taliban, but to get the local population to convince them not to join them. And that's a political goal. So, yes, war occupies this gray zone. And, you know, social media means that information can be weaponized to such a degree that, you know, the boundaries between war and peace are blurred. And it's dangerous because if war is indistinguishable from politics, politics never ends. And sort of, you know, we're getting into the stage now that, you know, if a soldier today, if a US soldier today dies in Afghanistan, is he a casualty of the 2001 war? The answer is we don't know. And that's the point.
David, so much of your book is about conflict overseas, places like Ukraine, places like Gaza, many other sites of warfare. But it just made me wonder about the United States. It made me wonder about here. I mean, even with our own extremely divisive politics, groups going to the political polls, we think of this country as having enough democratic pressure valves, checks and balances, the Constitution, elections every 2 years, that kind of grind, that kind of conflict, social media fueled conflict like you saw in Ukraine, can't happen here. Can social media ruin that?
I mean, do you mean actual physical conflict? I mean, look, put it this way. What social media does is, you know, we had this great utopian dream that social media, because it connects the world, would bring people together. And to a degree, it has. But it does something else. It splinters them apart. It breaks them apart. And it does this in two ways. The first is obvious. It you know, you can now fight with your opponents online. And you see this with Trump. You saw it in the UK with Brexit. But I'm sure, you know, you've had friends on Facebook unfriend someone else over Trump or over something else. So it makes you know, conflict much easier, and it creates division. The second way, which is more insidious, is that it cocoons us. You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, our friends, quote unquote, on Facebook, they're not all our friends in real life, but
no.
Largely speaking, I'm not saying all your friends, if you're a Democrat, all your friends will be Democrats, or if you're a Republican, they'll all be Republicans. But largely speaking, you will be friends with people who have a broad worldview. I mean, you're not going to be friends with a load of Nazis. The algorithm, Facebook algorithm, then calculates what you like and feeds you with yet more content. So you become cocooned in your own world and increasingly unable to see the other point of view. So it creates division, and that is a danger.
Division, but you're also talking about the siloing, which is one of the main conclusions of your book that I find incredibly dangerous and a bit harrowing, but it's an incredible look at the state of modern warfare in the age of social media. David Patrick Arikos, author of War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.